This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents This Is Real and You Are Completely Unprepared, The Days of Awe as a Journey of Transformation. Written by Alan Liu. Read by Alan Robertson. For Cheryl, my life and my breath. Chapter 1. The soul stretches out to contain itself. A map of the journey. You are walking through the world half asleep. It isn't just that you don't know who you are and that you don't know how or why you got here. It's worse than that. These questions never even arise. It is as if you are in a dream. Then the walls of the great house that surrounds you crumble and fall. You tumble out onto a strange street, suddenly conscious of your estrangement and your homelessness. A great horn sounds, calling you to remembrance, but all you can remember is how much you have forgotten. Every day, for a month, you sit and try to remember who you are and where you are going. By the last week of this month, your need to know these things weighs upon you. Your prayers become urgent. Then the great horn sounds in earnest 100 times. The time of transformation is upon you. The world is once again cracking through the shell of its egg to be born. The gate between heaven and earth creaks open. The book of life and the book of death are opened once again, and your name is written in one of them. But you don't know which one. The 10 days that follow are fraught with meaning and dread. They are days when it is perfectly clear every second that you live in the midst of a chain of ineluctable consequence, that everything you do, every prayer you utter, every intention you form, every act of compassion you perform, ripples out from the center of your being to the end of time. Anger and its terrible cost lie naked before you. Grievance gives way to forgiveness. At the same time, you become aware that you also stand at the end of a long chain of consequences. Many things are beyond your control. They are part of a process that was set in motion long ago. You find the idea of this unbearable. Then, just when you think you can't tolerate this one moment more, you are called together with a multitude in a great hall. A court has convened high up on the altar in the front of the hall. Make way! Make way! The judges of the court proclaim. For everyone must be included in the proceeding. No one, not even the usual outcasts, may be excluded. You are told that you are in possession of a great power, the power of speech, and that you will certainly abuse it. You are already forgiven for having abused it in the past, but in the end, it will save you. For the next 24 hours, you rehearse your own death. You wear a shroud. And like a dead person, you neither eat nor drink nor fornicate. You summon the desperate strength of life's last moments. A great wall of speech is hurled against your heart again and again. A fist beats against the wall of your heart relentlessly until you are broken-hearted and confess to your great crime. You are a human being. Guilty of every crime imaginable. Your heart is cracking through its shell to be reborn. Then a chill grips you. The gate between heaven and earth has suddenly begun to close. The multitude has swollen. It is almost as if the great hall has magically expanded to include an infinity of desperate souls. This is your last chance. Everyone has run out of time. Every heart has broken. The gate clangs shut. The great horn sounds one last time. You feel curiously light-hearted and clean. Some days later, you find yourself building a house, a curious house, an incomplete house, a house that suggests the idea of a house without actually being one. This house has no roof. There are a few twigs and branches on top, but you can see the stars and feel the wind through them. And the walls of this house don't go all the way around it either. Yet, as you sit in this house eating the bounty of the earth, you feel a deep sense of security and joy. Here, in this mere idea of a house, you finally feel as if you are home. The journey is over. At precisely this moment, the journey begins again. The curious house is dismantled. The king calls you in for a last intimate meal, and then you set out on your way again. This may all sound like a dream, a nightmare, and it is. It is a deep dream of human existence. It is also a description of the round of Jewish rituals that are observed every year between midsummer and midfall, roughly early August to mid-October, although this varies slightly from year to year. It is a gesture-by-gesture description of the stages of the days of awe, each one constituting a passage in this ancient journey of transformation. Tisha B'Av, the day of mourning for the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, the day of the crumbling of the great walls. Elul, the last month of the year, when the great horn of remembrance is sounded to begin the month of introspection that precedes the days of awe. Shlichot, the last week of fervent prayer that precedes Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah itself, the head of the year, the day of remembrance, the day of the 100 blasts and the 2 books. The 10 days of Teshuvah, the days of awe proper, the period of intense spiritual transformation that begins with Rosh Hashanah and ends with Yom Kippur, 10 days fraught with meaning and dread. Kol Nidre, the eve of Yom Kippur, when the great court is convened above and below. Yom Kippur itself, the day of atonement, the day we rehearse our own death, the day that comes to a close with the clanging shut of the great gates. And finally, Sukkot, a joyous coda to the journey, the autumnal harvest festival, during which we build and inhabit the sukkah, a booth, the barest outline of a house. R. Buckminster Fuller's students once asked him to name the most important figure of the 20th century. Sigmund Freud, he said without a moment's hesitation. They were shocked. Why Freud? Why not Einstein, about whom Fuller had written extensively, or some other figure from the world of science or economics or architecture to which he had devoted his considerable energy? So Fuller explained himself. Sigmund Freud, he said, was the one who had introduced the single great idea upon which all the significant developments of the 20th century had rested. The invisible is more important than the visible. You would never have had Einstein if Freud hadn't convinced the world of this first. You would never have had nuclear physics. For all Freud's animus against Judaism, his idea was an extremely Jewish one. In fact, it may not be too much to suggest that it is the Jewish idea. Judaism came into the world to bring the news that the invisible is more important than the visible. From the beginning of time, humans had seen the world as a play of competing forces, which they had personified as gods. The sea struggled against the earth. The rain either overwhelmed the forests and fields or famished them. Men and beasts hunted each other. Hatred and vengeance, love and compassion struggled for hegemony in the human heart. But Judaism came to say that beneath this appearance of conflict, multiplicity, and caprice, there was a oneness, a singularity, all-powerful and endlessly compassionate, endlessly just. In the visible world, we live out our routine and sometimes messy lives. We have jobs, families, and houses. Our lives seem quite ordinary and undramatic. It is only beneath the surface of this world that the real and unseen drama of our lives is unfolding. Only there that the walls of the house crumble and fall, that the horn sounds 100 times, that the gate between heaven and earth opens, and the great books of life and death open as well. It is there that the court is convened, that we rehearse our own death, that the gate closes again, and that we finally come home to the mere idea of the very house that crumbled and fell in the first place. If the purpose of ritual is to render the invisible visible, then what is the profound, universal, unseen, and unspoken reality that all of this ritual reflects? What journey of the soul, what invisible journey of transformation does all of this make visible? On this journey, our soul will awaken to itself. We will venture from innocence to sin and back to innocence again. This is a journey from denial to awareness, from self-deception to judgment. We will learn our divine name. We will move from self-hatred to self-forgiveness, from anger to healing, from hard-heartedness to broken-heartedness. This is the journey the soul takes to transform itself and to evolve, the journey from boredom and staleness, from deadness, to renewal. It is on the course of this journey that we confront our shadow and come to embrace it, that we come to know our deepest desires and catch a glimpse of where they come from, that we express the paradoxical miracle of our own being and the infinite power of simply being present, simply being who we are. It is the journey from little mind to big mind, from confinement in the ego to a sense of ourselves as a part of something larger. It is the journey from isolation to a sense of our intimate connection to all being. This is the journey on which we discover ourselves to be part of an inevitable chain of circumstances, the journey beyond death, the journey home. This is the longest journey we will ever make, and we must complete it in that brief instant before the gates of heaven clang shut. The journey I will describe in this audiobook is one of self-discovery, spiritual discipline, self-forgiveness, and spiritual evolution. It is the snapshot the Jewish people pull out every autumn of the great journey all human beings must make across this world. The journey from Tisha B'Av to Sukkot, from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, from birth to death and back to renewal again. Seeing yourself in this snapshot will help you chart the course of your own spiritual evolution. Every soul needs to express itself. Every heart needs to crack itself open. Every one of us needs to move from anger to healing, from denial to consciousness, from boredom to renewal. These needs did not arise yesterday. They are among the most ancient of human yearnings, and they are fully expressed in the pageantry and ritual of the days of awe, in the great journey we make between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. In ancient Israel, the seventh month of the year was an anxious time. All the other civilizations of the ancient Near East were sustained by great rivers. The Egyptians had the Nile, the Babylonians had the Tigris and the Euphrates, but Israel was completely dependent on rain. The rains came in the eighth month, so the seventh month was a time when the nation of Israel felt its life hanging in the balance. This utter dependence on the heavens seems to have given the ancient Israelites an intense sense of their dependence on God. It may very well have been this dependence that sensitized the Israelites to the existence of God in the first place. The ancient Israelites felt themselves to be part of a vast interpenetrating whole, a cosmos in which the weather and their own moral condition were active and interdependent constituents. The round of holidays we now call the Days of Awe gave form to this sense. Rosh Hashanah is never mentioned in the Torah. Rosh Hashanah means the head of the year, and it marks the start of the new year in today's Jewish calendar. But in biblical times, the new year began exactly 6 months before, in Nisan, the month in which Passover occurs. The Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, is mentioned in the Torah. It appears along with Passover, Shavuot, Sukkot, the new moon, and the Sabbath in the recitations of the sacred calendar which appear in the books of Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying also, on the 10th day of this the 7th month, there will be a day of atonement. It will be a holy gathering to you, and you will afflict your souls, and offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. And you will do no work on that very same day, for it is a day of atonement, to make atonement for you before the Lord your God. While there is no mention of Rosh Hashanah in these calendars, there is a special day mentioned 10 days before Yom Kippur, on the first day of the 7th month, precisely the day that would later become Rosh Hashanah. In biblical times, however, this day was called Yom HaZikaron, the Day of Remembrance, or Yom Zikaron Truah, the Day of the Blowing of the Horn for Remembrance. But who was to remember what? Was it a day when God was supposed to remember us? Were we supposed to remember God? Or was it a day when we were to begin to become mindful of our moral circumstances in preparation for the Day of Atonement that would soon be upon us? Was the sound of the ram's horn, the shofar, a mystical nexus between heaven and earth, or, as suggested by the Rambam, Maimonides, a medieval philosopher and legal authority and a towering figure in the world of Jewish thought, was it a wake-up call for us? Was it crying out to us, "Awake, awake, you sleepers, from your sleep, examine your deeds, return in repentance, remember your Creator"? Those of you who forget the truth and go astray the whole year in vanity and emptiness that neither profits nor saves, look to your souls. Examining the length and breadth of the tradition that would follow, following the tradition through its biblical, Talmudic, medieval, and modern periods, the answer is clearly all of the above. God's mindfulness of us is the sine qua non of this holiday season. If there were no consciousness out there aware of us, responding to us, this whole round of holidays would make no sense at all. Neither would life. The rains would fall at random, the heavens would shut themselves up, and we would live and die without meaning. Equally important is our awareness of God. We shouldn't imagine that this was any less problematic for the ancient Israelites than it is for us. If they found it easy, they wouldn't have needed 100 blasts of the great shofar to bring them back to an awareness of the supernal oneness or its inescapable sovereignty over all creation. But what seems to have been most clearly true of this day of the blowing of the horn for remembrance is that it was both connected with and preparatory to Yom HaKippurim, the Day of Atonement. But what was atonement in biblical times? And how did the ancient Israelites prepare for it? Atonement was a moral and spiritual purification, and the ancient Israelites believed that there were three ritual occasions that possessed an almost magical capacity to effect atonement. One, the propitiatory sacrifices one made at the Great Temple. Two, the day of Yom Kippur. And three, death itself. But as powerful as these occasions were, none of them could bring about atonement without the prerequisite of a verbal confession, an acknowledgement of the precise nature of our impurity spoken out loud. A vidui, a confession of sin, had to be recited as we offered the propitiatory sacrifices. It had to be recited on Yom Kippur, and it had to be recited on the deathbed as well. This recitation activated the considerable power each of these moments possessed. If there was no vidui, this power was lost. Awareness made this power actual and active in the world. Atonement still works this way, even though we no longer make propitiatory sacrifices. It is still the case that in order for Yom Kippur to effect atonement for us, we have to find a way from unconsciousness to consciousness. We have to become aware of our moral and spiritual condition. We have to become aware that we are not operating in a spiritual vacuum, that there is, in fact, a transcendent consciousness out there watching us with unbearable compassion as we blunder through the world. Moreover, we have to become aware of the precise nature of our blunders. The day of remembrance, or the day of the blowing of the horn for remembrance, or the day of mindfulness, for the Hebrew root zachar, as in Yom HaZikaron, suggests both remembrance and mindfulness, was the day when we began to cultivate such an awareness. So it was that by Talmudic times, Rosh Hashanah had become above all Yom HaDin, the day of judgment, the day when we began to see ourselves through the eyes of a consciousness beyond us. But it was not a final judgment. This judgment always stood in relation to Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. It could always be atoned for. All are judged on Rosh Hashanah, and the verdict is sealed on Yom Kippur, says the Tosefta, an early compendium of Talmudic teachings. The Babylonian Talmud gave this idea flesh and bones in the following story. Three books are opened on Rosh Hashanah. One for the completely evil, one for the completely righteous, and one for everyone in between. The completely righteous are written and sealed in the book of life immediately. The completely evil are written and sealed in the book of death immediately. Those in between stand suspended from Rosh Hashanah until Yom Kippur. If they merit it, they are written for life. If they do not merit it, they are written for death. How did one come to merit being written in the Book of Life? Four things will cause God to tear up, ma'akirin, the decree of judgment which has been issued against a person. Acts of righteousness, fervent prayer, changing one's name, and changing one's behavior. There are echoes of these two Talmudic sources in the liturgical high point of both the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services, the Une Tane Tokef prayer. On Rosh Hashanah it is written, and on Yom Kippur it is sealed, who will live and who will die. But Teshuvah, returning, turning, repentance, prayer, and righteous deeds can transform Ma'avirin, the evil of the decree. The liturgy is obviously derived from the Talmudic story about the three books. Both claim that righteous deeds, prayer, and turning, changing one's behavior in the first case, and teshuvah in the second, will modify the divine decree that has been issued on Rosh Hashanah, but the operative verbs are strikingly different. The Talmud claims that these activities will actually cause the decree to be torn up, ma'akirin. That which was decreed to happen will not in fact happen. The liturgy, however, makes a very different claim, namely that prayer, righteousness, and teshuvah will not change what happens to us, rather they will change us. We will understand what happens differently. These activities will not tear up the decree. Rather, they will transform ma'avirin, the evil of the decree. Spiritual practice won't change what happens. Rather, it will help us to experience what happens not as evil, but simply as what happens. Spiritual practice will help us to understand that everything that happens, even the decree of death, flows from God. This difference of one little verb represents an immense theological sea change, 1,000 years in the making. It took approximately that long for Jews to notice that there were people in their midst who spent the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur praying fiercely, performing righteous deeds until they collapsed in exhaustion, repenting prodigiously and with unassailable sincerity, but who nevertheless died during the following year. In fact, there were people who behaved this way all year long and still died. So, when the Torah spoke of atonement and the Talmud spoke of tearing up the divine decree, obviously they were not talking about something that took place in the visible world. They were talking about an invisible process. They were talking about a spiritual process. They were talking about transformation. But while this realization solved the most pressing theological problems rather nicely, it also upped the spiritual ante considerably. Could this kind of transformation realistically be achieved in 10 days? Of course not. We were no longer talking about an act of propitiatory magic like animal sacrifice. Now we were talking about something real, something that took time, and something that had an authentic rhythm and span of its own, and could not be hurried. And so began the layering on of ritual. The process of transformation began to expand from what originally occupied 10 days to what now takes just over 2 months, stretching out into a period of time long enough to hold the journey the soul had to make. The period of preparation became both longer and more complex, being divided eventually into several components, and we began to see the days of awe as stretching beyond themselves as well, concluding not with the great closing of the gate at the end of Yom Kippur, as they used to do, but extending out to the end of Sukkot, nearly 2 weeks later. Moreover, it became clear that this was a process that never ended, that rather it stretched out to the infinite horizon. These 2 months merely stood for something that was going on all the time. The business of transformation was going on all the time. It never stopped. The 2 month period in question was merely a time when we focused on it, when we gave form to something invisible that lay dormant yet was possible to awaken at every moment of our lives. So the walls of our great house are crumbling all the time, and not just in midsummer at Tisha B'Av when we mourn the destruction of the temple. Every moment of our lives, the sacred house of our life, the constructs by which we live and to which we hold on so fiercely, nevertheless falls away. Every moment we take in a breath, and the world comes into being, and then we let out a breath, and the world falls away. Every moment we experience what we take to be death, loss, and failure. When we become aware that this is happening, we feel dislocated, uprooted, filled with sorrow and anxiety. We feel estranged from our own lives, and we realize how much these constructs have been keeping us from the reality of our lives, how we have been using them to give us distance from the gnawing suspicion that we have no house, that we are afloat in a great sea of being, an endless flow of becoming in which we are connected to all beings. The great journey of transformation begins with the acknowledgement that we need to make it. It is not something we are undertaking for amusement, nor even for the sake of convention. Rather, it is a spiritual necessity. And our need to be more conscious, to awaken from the deep dream that has held us in its thrall, is always there too, not just when the shofar blows on the first day of Elul. The soul wants to awaken. Every day we are called to the present moment of our lives. Every moment we feel ourselves falling out of real time and back into the dream, but then the horn blows and we begin to return to life once again. And this awakening is always a matter of the utmost urgency, not just in that last week before Rosh Hashanah at Shlichot. It is always something very real for which we are completely unprepared. And the time of transformation is always upon us. The world is always cracking through the shell of its egg to be born. The gate between heaven and earth is always creaking open. The book of life and the book of death are open every day, and our name is written in one or the other of them at every moment, and then erased and written again the moment after that. We are constantly becoming, continuously redefining ourselves. This doesn't just happen on Rosh Hashanah. And every day of our life is fraught with meaning and dread, not just the 10 days of Teshuvah. We always live at an unbearable nexus. Everything we do, every prayer we utter, every intention we form, every act of compassion we perform, always ripples out from the center of our being to the end of time. We always stand at the end of a long chain of consequences as well, and we are always struggling to control things that won't submit to our control, personal outcomes that were set in motion long ago. And there is always a trial going on, not just the heavenly court that convenes at Kol Nidre on the eve of Yom Kippur. We are called to judgment at every moment. Our response to every moment is a judgment on us, one that is continuously unfolding and subject to continuous modification. And every moment is a rehearsal for our death. From the day we are born, we are engaged in the process of dying, not only because the larger arc of our life is moving in that direction, but because we experience death moment by moment. We die to the world every time we breathe out. And every time we breathe in, every time our breath returns to us of its own accord, we are reborn, and the world rises up into being again. And our heart is always breaking, and the gate is always clanging shut. It is always the last minute. We are always desperate, not just at Ne'ilah, the final moments of Yom Kippur. And the houses we live in never afford us real security. Their walls and roofs are never complete. They never really keep us from the world or from harm. And it is only when we realize this that we are truly home. And the task of finding an authentic source of security falls to us all the time. Not just on Sukkot, when we leave our houses and go and sit in an imaginary house with the wind in our hair and the stars shining down on the top of our head. So this concatenation of ritual, this dance that begins on Tisha B'Av and ends on Sukkot, that begins with the mournful collapse of a house and ends with the joyful collapse of a house, this intentional spasm that awakens us and carries us through death and back to life again, stands for the journey the soul is always on. It is a map drawn by the soul of the journey it must take, of the journey it is already taking. Beginning from the barest of biblical outlines, the soul has filled in this map with its own imperatives. Our souls are making this journey. Yours and mine. The trip will go better for us if we know where we're going. Chapter 2. Everywhere he went, he was heading for home. Teshuvah. Before we begin this journey, before we walk this map of the soul step by step, let's first step back and take a look at the essential gesture of the journey, the single, consistent movement that characterizes it from start to finish. I am speaking here of teshuvah, a Hebrew word that we struggle to translate. We call it repentance. We call it return. We call it a turning. It is all of these things and none of these things. It is a word that points us to the realm beyond language, the realm of pure motion and form. One summer, my wife, Cheryl, and I took a whitewater rafting trip. We were out on the Rogue River in western Oregon for 3 straight days, and the experience was so intense that it engraved itself on my mind very deeply. For the rest of the week, I saw the river whenever I closed my eyes. The banks rolling by as we were carried inexorably toward the end of the day. I even began to dream of the river, and I realized that the reason this image stayed with me so powerfully was because it was already there. Those 3 days on the river had dredged up one of my deepest atavistic memories, the image of a voyage down a river, the banks of time rolling by as we head toward home. Now over dangerous rapids, now over still waters, now at a leisurely float, now at a lightning plunge, but always moving, always homeward bound toward the sea. Yet this journey home is a curious one. Rivers only run one way. The home we leave to begin this journey is necessarily a different place than the home we arrive at in the end. Abraham, the first Jew, whose nickname, Ha-Ivri, may very well have meant the one who crossed the river, began his biblical journey by leaving the home of his birth, his father's house, the land he was born in, and setting out for an unknown land. This unknown land was his real home, the home God had destined him for, and the children of Israel had to leave Egypt, the birthplace in which they had never felt at home, and undertake a 40-year journey across the wilderness to their real home, a place none of them had ever seen. But here is the $64,000 question. Why do these biblical figures all have to leave home in order to find a home, in order to leave again? More to the point, why do we? Why do we have to leave our home to find a home and then leave again? I think this is a profoundly Jewish question, not just because we are wanderers, a people destined to live without a true home for close to 2,000 years while somehow managing to hold on to our identity, but also because the Jewish sacred calendar, the sacred year, embodies the essential paradox of this homeward journey. Nowhere is this more evident than during the months surrounding the high holidays, that quarter of the year that begins in midsummer with the observance of Tisha B'Av, the day when we mourn the destruction of the temple, then moves through the high holidays themselves, a period of intense self-revelation and purification, and ends with Sukkot, the time of our great rejoicing, when we erect a house that is not really a house, a home that is not really a home, a time when we seem to have come to the end of a journey only to begin it again. My earliest dreams as a child in Brooklyn, New York, were all of being lost, of not being able to find my way home. I would be walking through towering and unfamiliar urban canyons, searching for a sign of home and finding none. I remember waking from these dreams in a sweat and not knowing where I was. In 1970, at the age of 26, I came to live in Walla, California. There, I continued to dream of my lost home. In this version of the dream, I had been taken captive by a huge man with a fez, a shaven head, and bare arms. He took me back to a small apartment crammed full of books on the arcane sciences and strapped me into a chair. Then he pulled a lever, and I died. I remember saying to myself in the dream, "You can't die in a dream," but I died nevertheless. I remember the cold horror I felt as everything went black. But then I was reborn. My inert consciousness slowly came back to life, slowly filled with a vague, misty light that got progressively clearer and more articulated, and then there I was. It was 1955 in White Plains, New York, a time and place of nearly perfect order and tranquility. The world was in perfect balance. American culture was still intact. There were 8 baseball teams in each league. The Brooklyn Dodgers had just won the World Series. Rounded cars without tail fins were parked on a sunny street lined with rose bushes full of red roses. Why did I have that dream precisely then and there? It seems obvious to me now. There has never been a time or a place in either my life or the life of the culture when there was such an acute sense of dislocation, of having been wrenched out of one's psychic home, as there was in Walla, California, circa 1970. American social life was in chaos. Revolution was in the air. My marriage was collapsing, and the San Andreas Fault went right through my backyard. There was a gaping crater about 40 feet wide between the north and south ends of my property in Walla, left over from the big one in 1906. My favorite activity in those days was to go down to the middle of the big redwood forest where the north and south forks of the Walla River converged, about a mile before the river ran into the sea. I used to sit at this place for hours, watching the currents of these two channels collide. They would wrap around each other in shifting spirals, and then shoot off together toward the ocean, joined now in a single, swirling flow. I was mesmerized by this place, the fluidity of it. It was a place of almost perfect instability, constant swirling change. I tried to draw it. I tried to write music that expressed this motion. Poetry about how that movement felt inside my soul. But I couldn't capture it. It eluded me. There was nothing to grab hold of. And this was true of my life then, too. I couldn't get hold of it. It was eluding me. There was nothing to grab onto. No wonder I had that dream of a perfect home. The dream of the lost home must be one of the deepest of all human dreams. Certainly, it is the most ancient dream of the Jewish people, embodied in our national resolve to someday rebuild the Bayit, the home, the great temple in Jerusalem. And this dream is the basis of that most profound expression of the American psyche, the game of baseball, a game whose object is to leave home in order to return to it again, transformed by the time spent circling the bases. And that famous shortstop Odysseus also played this game, propelled around the world by the same dream of returning home in the end, transformed by the journey, and healed by it as well. And the truth is, every time we come home, home is different, and so are we. My mother still lives in the house near White Plains where we moved when I was 7. It is almost unbearable to go back to my old room there. All my old books are still on the bookshelf, and the oil painting of saxophonist Charlie Parker still hangs over my desk. But I feel like a ghost there, not at home in the home I grew up in any longer, but haunted everywhere else by the grid that home left in my psyche, and the differential between that grid and wherever else I happen to find myself at the moment. Some years ago, I returned to the Bay Area after an absence of 10 years. The move was very much motivated by a dream of return, the dream of returning to my adopted home. But home was different now. 100 times I had a profoundly dislocating experience while going down a street in San Francisco, in Oakland, in Berkeley. The street would seem familiar to me, intimately familiar, but subtly altered also, and I was disoriented by both the change and the familiarity. We spend most of our lives, I think, in this strange dance, pushing forward to get back home. Teshuvah, turning, return, repentance, is the central gesture of the high holiday season. It is a circular motion, Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik wrote in On Teshuvah, his classic work on the days of awe. If you are moving along the circumference of a circle, it might seem at first as if the starting point is getting farther and farther away, but actually it is also getting closer and closer. The calendar year is such a circle. On Rosh Hashanah, a new year begins, and every day is one day farther from the starting point, but every day is also a return, a drawing closer to the completion of the cycle. The biblical prophet Samuel served the people of Israel in circuit every year. Every year he went from Ramah to Bethel to Gilgal to Mitzpeh, and then finally back to Ramah again. The moment he left Ramah, he was already returning there, Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out. Everywhere he went, he was heading for home. This is not our usual sense of time. Ordinarily, we see time as running in a straight line, but Rabbi Soloveitchik put his finger on how time really flows. What we call teshuvah is a primal gesture, a primordial sense of the healing power of the journey we make through life, the time spent circling the bases. Numbers express this in their natural and universal urge to return to 1 after 10. We see this urge also in what psychiatrists call the repetition compulsion, the unconscious craving to master the unresolved elements of our life. According to this theory, we never leave the age at which trauma occurs. We keep returning, trying to move past it, to break through. If we don't, we inflict it on our children. So it is that we read in the papers of a parent who beats his children, and then it comes out that this father had been beaten when he was a child. We hear the story of a mother who was shamed into dropping out of school at age 14, and we are shocked to learn that she is now pressuring her own teenage daughter into full-time work. In fact, it is precisely these unresolved elements that cause us to return. Soloveitchik wrote, "When man sins, he creates a distance between himself and God. To sin means to remove oneself from the presence of the Master of the Universe. I was standing before you, And sin came and estranged me from you, and I no longer feel that I am before you. The whole essence of the precept of repentance is longing, yearning, pining to return again. Longing develops only when one has lost something precious. Sin pushes us far away and stimulates our longing to return. This is why Rambam wrote, "How powerful is repentance, for it brings man closer to the presence of God." So, Tisha B'Av, the day when we remember our estrangement from God, is the beginning of the process of Teshuvah. This very estrangement is the engine that drives us on our journey back home, back to God. One spring, in the course of my pastoral rounds, I became extremely fond of a young woman named Sonia. I was visiting her during a bout with cancer that eventually took her life. She was a brilliant, open person whose deep sense of spirituality only grew considerably deeper as her illness progressed. This woman had a very difficult relationship with her mother, and this difficulty had created a distance between them which even her illness could not overcome. Her mother lived in another city. She came to the area several times on business when her daughter was in the hospital, but she didn't come to see her then. Toward the end of her illness, Sonia's mind began to slip. She had been a brilliant mathematician, but now she had difficulty expressing even the simplest thoughts. One unforgettable afternoon, when I came to see her, there was something she really needed to tell me, a story, actually, and she summoned all her concentration in order to do it. It seemed terribly important to her that she tell me this story. She made everyone else leave the room before she began, and she shooed away two doctors and several close friends who tried to come into the room before she was finished. This was the story. The week before, two friends had visited to give her an extremely deep massage, both of them working on her at once. As ill as she was, she began to experience sensations of pleasure such as she had never experienced before. Then, suddenly, a deeply buried memory burst upon her. It was a memory of her mother. Her mother was very young, perhaps 20 or 21, and Sonia herself was just an infant, perhaps 2, perhaps even younger. Her mother was gazing down at her with a look of absolutely pure and intense love, as if Sonia were the most beautiful thing her mother had ever seen, and that was the way her mother looked to Sonia as well. "That was the starting point," Sonia said. What did she mean by this? Did she mean that this moment of pure feeling, of pure love, was the starting point, the basis of all the relationships she would have later on in her life? Or did she mean that it could become the beginning of a reconciliation with her mother now? Or did it mean that this memory was something essential, something she could hold on to and possibly even take with her through the difficult crossing that lay ahead? I had an urgent need to know what she meant, as urgent as her own need to tell me this story had been, but it was too late. She couldn't tell me anymore. It had taken her last ounce of concentration to tell me the story, and now she had nothing left at all. She fell into incoherence, and then a deep, deep sleep. We never spoke again. A short while later, I read a newspaper story about Dwight Gooden, the baseball player. Dwight Gooden had just come back from the dead, so to speak. After one of the most brilliant beginnings in the history of baseball, Gooden's career had gone down in a maelstrom of premature fame, drug involvement, and denial. Then he righted himself, beat his problem, matured as a human being, returned to baseball and even to New York to pitch again, this time for the Yankees. And after a period of struggle, he found his way back to a rhythm of sorts and became a capable pitcher for the Yankees. There was always about him the weight of his lost potential, what he could have become but did not. But there were flashes of his early brilliance, too. And finally, he pitched the first no-hitter of his career. His father, whose heart had ached to see Gooden suffer so after such a brilliant beginning, now lay dying in a hospital in St. Petersburg, Florida. The day after the no-hitter, Dwight Gooden flew back home to Florida to give his father the ball he had pitched it with. He said he owed it to his father for all the days when he was a kid, and his father would take him out to the fields to throw a ball back and forth with him. I think one of the things we learn in the course of the long journey home is to keep our eye on the ball, on the starting point, on the things in life that are essential, that sustain us. One of the ways our lives heal us is to teach us this. Judaism believes in the particularity of time, that certain times have special spiritual properties, that Shabbat has an extra degree of holiness, that Pesach, Passover, is the time of our liberation, that Shavuot is a time unusually conducive to revelation. But they have these special properties only when we are mindful. If we consciously observe Shabbat, Shabbat has this holy quality. If we don't, it is merely Friday night, merely Saturday afternoon. And when it is invested with our awareness, Yom Kippur, the day itself, has the power to heal, to atone. Our tradition makes precisely the same claim for death. Death, the only other time in our life when we recite the Vidui, when we bring ourselves to the point of full awareness, also atones. Death, the destination of our journey through life, also heals. Teshuvah is the little death that connects us to the big one, or as the Rambam says, the repentant should change his name, as if to say, I am another, I am not the same person who did these deeds. It is as if that person has died. This is why this day resembles a dress rehearsal for our death. There is a story about Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite. One day his older brother died, and a newspaper got the story wrong and printed Alfred's obituary instead. Alfred opened the paper that morning and had the unusual experience of reading his obituary while he was still alive. Dr. Alfred Nobel, who became rich by finding ways to kill more people faster than ever before, died yesterday, the obituary began. Alfred threw down the paper. That's not how I want to be remembered, he said. That's not what's important to me, he said, and right then and there, he decided to throw his entire fortune into rewarding people for bettering this world and bringing it closer to peace. Yom Kippur is the day we all get to read our own obituary. It's a dress rehearsal for our death. That's why we wear a kittel, a shroud-like garment on this day. Why we refrain from life-affirming activities such as eating, drinking, and procreating. We are rehearsing the day of our death because death, like Yom Kippur, atones. And what our tradition is affirming with these claims is the healing power of time. What our tradition is affirming is that when we reach the point of awareness, everything in time, everything in the year, everything in our life conspires to help us. Everything becomes the instrument of our redemption. The banks of the river roll by. We leave home to return home. Loss is inevitable. Entropy is a fact of life. What's done cannot be undone, but it can be healed. It can even become the instrument of our healing. The year rolls by with all its attendant loss and failure, death and disappointment, but at the end of the year there is a day that heals. Life rolls by, and the same is true of the end of life as well. The passage of time brings awareness, and the two together, time and consciousness, heal. The voyage between death and birth, between the home we come from and the home at the end of our voyage, is a journey of healing. This is precisely the journey we take every year during the high holidays, a journey of transformation and healing, a time which, together with consciousness, heals and transforms us. And the urge to return, that primal impulse buried deep in our psyche, is the current that propels us down this river. It is this impulse that launches the healing process. We see this not only in the course of the year or the course of our lives, we can see this every moment of our lives as well. Every moment of our lives, our suffering, our clinging to our lives, drives us out of our lives, away from home. and every moment our awareness brings us back, returns us to ourselves, because we need to return, need to come back. Consciousness and the passage of time heal. Loss is inevitable, but as time passes, what we really have and who we really are begins to become clear. The world of illusion begins to lose its power over us as we approach the world of truth. The thrall of the material world begins to lose its hold on us, and the objects in our life begin to fall away, and it becomes increasingly clear that those things which are the least solid, the least material, the least substantial, last the longest, have the greatest effect, and in the end, are the only things we leave behind. Rabbi Laura Zell tells of a visit she once made to her 95-year-old grandmother at an old age home in Boston. Her grandmother, a beautiful woman with perfectly smooth skin and radiant eyes, had obviously taken great care in dressing and making herself up to look good for her granddaughter. Rabbi Zell had brought pictures of her family to show her, the great-grandchildren her grandmother barely knew, the husband she had only met a few times. But the time passed very quickly, and far too soon it was time to go. As Rabbi Zell stood to leave, her grandmother said, "I want to give you something." "What can I give you?" Her world had become continuously smaller as she aged. She had outlived her husband, all of her siblings, most of her friends, and even a grandchild. She had moved from a lovely home to a spacious apartment to a single room in a nursing home. All of her furniture and most of her chattels had long since been distributed to her grandchildren. What was there left to give? Rabbi Zell writes, "With great ceremony, she signaled her aide to open the top drawers and bring forward a box. In it were several silk scarves, once beautiful but now yellowed with age. 'Here,' she said, 'I want you to have these.' I started to protest that I didn't wear scarves, but suddenly I understood. She just wanted me to take something of her with me, back to my life so far away in California, back to those great-grandchildren she barely knew. She wanted to accompany me in some way, protect me like she used to when I was little, and she wanted to make sure I would remember her after she was gone." Rabbi Zell's grandmother was a woman well healed by life. The passage of time had reduced her to her essential nature, and this is what she had passed on to her granddaughter in the form of a worn scarf. Little by little, her house and then all her possessions had been stripped away. Little by little, her life had carried her home, returned her to a sense of what was most important. It takes the living of a whole life, a life and a death, the complete journey, to learn that. We are all making that journey, and the high holidays are a dress rehearsal for it, a time when we are all stripped down, a time that gives us an intimation of what this long, strange journey home is all about. The passage of time, another year, like our life, like our death, heals us, carries us toward home, makes us whole, gives us a sense of what is important in life. One spring, I took my elder daughter, Hannah, away for a little vacation. It had been a very hard year for her, a hard year for the whole family, and I thought it would be good if we spent a few days alone together. Someone had offered us their summer house in Sebastopol to stay, and so we went there. Only after we'd arrived did it occur to us that Hannah had been born in Sebastopol and had lived there for the first 2 years of her life. I showed her the house we used to live in. The next morning we drove out to the coast along the Russian River, as my wife and I had done so often when she was pregnant with Hannah. We drove past the inn where Hannah had been conceived on our wedding night, where my wife had dreamed that we were driving through the stars in an old pickup truck, and we stopped to pick Hannah up. Then we drove up the coast to Wallala, and I found myself heading straight for that spot in the redwoods where the north and south forks of the Wallala River converge. Hannah and I got out of the car and stood together by this spot, watching the currents swirl together. The water was green and blue and brown. Each pebble beneath our feet was distinct, had been brought there by the movements of the current, by chance, and destiny, and design. And I realized that if I had never lived here with my first wife, then the next